Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. In the past 50 years, a doubling of the world's population has resulted in vast increases in the consumption of food, of water, of fuel. One result is habitat loss for animals and birds that are part of the ecosystem that sustains life. At the same time, the trade in elephant ivory and rhino horns and shark fins have threatened all three species. What can we do as individuals, as societies, to preserve our ecosystem? I'll be in conversation with Jonathan Foley. He's senior scholar at the California Academy of Sciences, and joining us will be Peter Knights, executive director of WildAid. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. I'm going to start, Jonathan, by asking you to give us a sense of the context for the discussion we're going to have tonight. We've had a doubling of human populations in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. What has that meant?
Yeah, well, we live in a very, interesting time in all of human history. If you go back archaeological record or so, something like a human being, our ancestors, eventually hominids, eventually us, something like us has been walking this planet for, 6 million years, they tell us. That's like 300,000 generations. And during all of that time, one fact was undeniably true through almost all of that time. The Earth was big, really big, and we were very small. What we did didn't have that much of an influence on the global environment. But in the last two human generations or so, that completely flipped around. Suddenly we became the dominant force on this planet, and the Earth now seems much, much, much smaller. And you referenced an interesting fact. In the last 50 years, the human population more or less doubled during that time, just in 50 years. At the same time, though, the world's economy grew eightfold, adjusted for inflation. So you get twice as many people, but doing eight times more stuff. And it put a lot of pressure on this planet, primarily through a tripling of global food demand, is huge, a tripling of global water use, and a quadrupling of global energy use in fossil fuels. I'm turning 50 next week. That all happened in my lifetime. And it happened in, what's kind of amazing is not only did that outpace any other period in human history, it outpaced the entire sum of human history and human evolution combined in just 50 years. So that's the moment we've inherited, and it's the moment we're going to be passing on to our descendants. And so we have to make a choice now about what kind of planet we want to leave for the future. And what's happening, in my mind, is there are a lot of things happening, but the big ones are huge amounts of habitat loss and degradation, primarily from agriculture, water use, and indirectly through energy use. But also, we'll hear more about wildlife trade and poaching and other issues from Peter, who's a world-renowned expert on this. But also now the specter of climate change. Even if we do restore habitats, even if we do stop degrading land and water where critters live, and even if we stop poaching and utilizing them in unsustainable ways, the very nature of our planet is changing as well. So we've now inherited a so-called wicked problem to deal with the future of our biosphere and the species we want to share this planet with, and the kind of planet we're going to leave our future generations. So, this is it. People often ask me, is it a good time to be alive or a really bad time to be alive? Because there's some good things happening and some really bad things happening at the same time. And I just look at you and say, well, which one do you want? Because it's your choice. We actually have the agency to change the world. We have the ability to do this. Everything I just mentioned is solvable, but we have to decide to do it. And that's the thing I hope we talk about today, is whether we'll stand up and make that choice, because it's one that'll affect the future of entire civilization.
So let's take it from the global to the personal. The California Academy of Sciences has something called Planet Vision, I think, that gives us sort of concrete things we can be doing. I know because I've dutifully checked off the list myself, but concrete steps we can be taking. There are students in the audience. Why don't you share those steps with us?
Yeah, thanks for the plug. We've developed, a lot of people come to a museum or an aquarium or a zoo or what are these? Which is amazing, by the way. Museums and aquariums get about a 90% approval rating by Americans, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. We're the only thing left. So don't tell anybody, but we're still trusted. It's weird. So people would often ask us, like, hey, I trust the place like a Cal Academy or the Exploratorium or Monterey Bay Aquarium. We have a lot of these great places in our neighborhood. And ask, what should I do to combat, let's say, climate change or ecosystem decline or the decline of our precious natural resources? And we said, well, there's a very long list of things we can do, but let's get started with the basics. And they were around food, water, and energy. We said, that's kind of the 80-20 rule of the global environment. A lot of the problems stem from how we use and produce food, water, and energy. A whole bunch of other stuff too. We'll hear about others too. But if we don't get these right, we're not going to get it all right. So in food, for example, they're often the things that aren't so sexy, but they're very important. It turns out food waste is by far the number one problem in the food system. And we like to debate organic, GMO, blah, blah, blah. Food waste is actually the biggest problem because 40% of all the food grown on the planet and all of the land, all of the water, all the chemicals, all the wildlife displaced, tied to that, are wasted and never even eaten. 40%. And agriculture is by far the biggest thing we've ever done to this planet so far. So that's huge. That's 40% opportunity. Second, diets. Eating lots and lots of red meat, not so good for the planet. Less, I'm not saying absolutely cut it out, but cut it down. Maybe a little less. Maybe put it on the side of the plate instead of the center of the plate. Maybe not every day. That would be a big help. And maybe grass-fed versus feedlot. That would probably be helpful too. So things like that. That's kind of what we're getting at. And energy, similar things as, you know, first, like conservation, kind of simple things, or heating, lighting, transportation, all things that'll save you money, make your life better. Then you can think about the Tesla if you can afford it or whatever. And same with electricity. Before you buy the solar panels, let's make sure you did change all the light bulbs and, you know, make sure you deal with your refrigerators and things like that. So they're kind of simple steps. If you'd like to find out more, it's planetvision.com. Where we have scientists who've kind of weighed in and said, you know, what are the first five things we could do around food and water and energy? And there are things you and I can do, but there's a parallel track for it's not enough for us citizens to do it all by ourselves. We do need to do our part, but we also need business to do its part, and we need policymaking institutions to do their part in governance. And so we've kind of outlined in Planet Vision a level for regular folks like you and me, and for business and enterprise level kind of decision makers, as well as policymakers. And they're all tied together and based on science. But they're trying to be pragmatic and look for the biggest levers we can pull first and the ones that kind of get us the farthest along. But it won't be it's not going to solve all the problems, but at least get us going in the right direction pretty quickly if we put our minds to it.
One thing you've said in the past is, look, we've got we have the knowledge, we have the science, we have the technology, we have the tools. What we need is a change in culture. So I wanted to turn, I'm going to ask you more about that, but I also wanted to turn to Peter, because this seems to be what you've done brilliantly, is when it comes to the trade in wildlife and wildlife products, is change attitudes first and foremost, and then go at the other issues. What made you land on that?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there's only two real environmental issues in the world, and one of them is population and the other is consumption. And it's factors of those that affect every other problem. And I would also say that probably the least sustainable consumption of all is using the rhino horn from the last northern white rhino, or, you know, you can't get any more unsustainable than that. And when I started off working in this area, I do think it ultimately is going to depend on a culture change and an aspirational change of what we value. And I did think that it's hard sometimes for people to envisage climate change and these big, huge issues, but people can relate to, you know, there's only three of this species left or two of that, and that's wrong, and we're fundamentally doing something wrong if we get to that. And I've had the experience of working all around the world, and I've found in every culture people can understand and acknowledge that. They may have different attitudes about animal welfare and things like that, but they have the same basic notion that to destroy a species is wrong, culturally and economically and every other reason. So I got working on endangered species because I was working with the Environmental Investigation Agency at the time. Half the African elephants, this was 1989, half the African elephants had disappeared in the last 15 years. And nobody was even really talking about it. And if it had carried on at the same rate, then, you know, we'd be down to probably, you know, a few thousand elephants left now. And yet nobody was talking about it. And clearly it was wrong on an economic point of view to do this. It was wrong on an ethical thing. But it was still carrying on, largely driven by greed and the want to make money from ivory trade. So that's what first got me into this area of endangered species. And then doing the investigations, we were using undercover cameras and fake companies to sort of infiltrate the wildlife trade. At both ends. So
this is the James Bond of wildlife.
James
trade.
Bond without the fast women and the fast cars. Using undercover techniques to get inside the trade to show what was happening. And what we were finding at the one end in Africa was that there would never be enough money to enforce your way out of this, and with all kinds of problems with corruption and things like that at that end, which were sort of long-term institutional problems and cultural problems which need to be addressed over the long term. But at the other end in Asia, where a lot of the products were going, like ivory, rhino horn, bear gallbladder, people had no idea of what was happening. So I had things like a rhino horn trader say to me, well, the rhino died of old age and someone's picking up the horn and I'm just kind of recycling it. So what's the problem with that? And when you said to them, well, actually, look, the rhinos now are guarded. They're guarded 24/7. Not only the rhinos being killed, but the rangers are being killed. The poachers are being killed. It's a war. People were generally shocked. And there was a big disconnect between the people buying the products and what was happening in the field. And when they found out, they were genuinely shocked.
I think many people didn't know that an elephant had to die in order for the tusks to be...
Some people thought they grew back shark fin. You know, some people, I think it was like 40% said... the fins grew back, so it was okay. Mm. And then even with shark fin, the mandarin is actually fish wing soup. So it doesn't even mention sharks. Mm. And people didn't, they thought it was a fish. Well, there's plenty of fish, so eating this is no problem at all. Sharks reproduce very slowly. So it was a massive gap in information. And I think also the whole thing came from the attitude that it wasn't that people were being malicious, which I think a lot of people, well, Asian people don't care about wildlife. And I'm like, well, I'm working there all the time and people actually really do care, but they have to have the right information or they don't know what to care about. Mm-hmm. And so there was this information gap, and that's what we sought to do, is to actually just connect people who were consuming to the products and the process they were going through, working with cultural icons from those countries.
And your fundamental message is actually the same as Jonathan's, and that is that you can make a difference. What is it, the slogan you use?
Well, the slogan is, when the buying stops, the killing can too. In Chinese, it's no killing, no buying. And it's getting back to the same issue. It's about the consumption. And, you know, we get to vote every so often, but we vote every time we make a purchase. You know, we vote the kind of world we want, the products we want, the chains. And it's connecting people with the responsibility is really what it's about. And then what we found, having done that and given the information, is that people generally responded very favorably once they had that information.
Mm-hmm. So once the message is you stop buying, it stops happening, the messengers are who?
Well, we started with Jackie Chan, which was a good place to start. And then we also had Yao Ming,
the actor, movie star,
loved all over Asia from India. And strangely enough, he's very popular in Africa because, you know, you have people watching the TV and you don't really need much dialogue. And everybody loves Jackie Chan all around the world. And he was a great person to get involved and engaged.
And Yao Ming is the basketball player.
So later on, Yao Ming, who, you know, people ask me, well, who is Yao Ming and how is he important in Chinese culture? And there will only ever be one Yao Ming, because Yao Ming's success in the NBA was just as China was emerging as an international power. And he kind of symbolized the rise of China. And then, of course, he carried the flag in the Beijing Olympics, which is, you know, probably the most important event in China we'll be alive for. And so he has this unique, iconic... symbolism, as well as being 7'6", which doesn't hurt either. He's an amazing figure physically and also in his leadership. And having these two icons, who I can't think of anyone who better we could have got, embrace these issues was just amazing. And
so what had to be learned about rhino horn? What were the, I mean, I know it played a role in traditional medicine. What were the beliefs about rhino horn? What was the motivation for buying?
Well, the first thing is these things change. I mean, we had a conversation earlier with the students asking questions, and they're saying, well, culture is never static. Culture is always changing. So traditionally, rhino horn was used as a fever reducer. And in very large quantities, rhino horn, as buffalo horn, does slightly reduce fevers. So it came from actually a basis. But of course, now we've got things that are very cheap and available that can reduce fever much more effectively. But what we've found is that in the new economic boom, You know, suddenly rhino horn was an aphrodisiac, which it never was traditionally. Suddenly in somebody in Vietnam says, oh, it cures cancer. And the word goes around, it cures cancer. So I've sat with the head of a TV network in Vietnam who said, I've got to confess something. I'm very sorry, but my father, 5 years ago, my father was dying of cancer. And these people came to me and said, the only thing that will save your father is rhino horn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, now I know it's keratin, because from our campaigns, it's keratin like your fingernails. Of course it couldn't do it. I was stupid, and I feel awful, because not only did I not help my dad, but I also killed a rhino, effectively. So the traditional beliefs became changed by marketing. And I liken it to, you know, the gold rush here, where people were selling snake oil. And basically this stuff, for many people, it will do whatever you want it to do. The salesman will tell you. Mm-hmm. It's this. And the irony in Vietnam, where they were selling it for a cancer cure, was a lot of the time they were actually giving people buffalo horn. So even if they did believe it worked, which they didn't, it was a con. They weren't even giving you the real thing anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty horrible scenario. And China actually banned rhino horn in 1993 in traditional medicine. And traditional medicine started using a lot of different things and essentially moved on. And between 1993 and 2008, there was almost no rhino poaching in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's not the case that we've always had rhino poaching. In 2008, what changed was Vietnam came on the market. They started marketing it. It was being sold in clubs to cure hangovers. So we think one of our theories is that the Vietnamese organized crime was sending amphetamines and heroin and trafficking women to Africa. And it wanted another product to send back the other way. Because very often with organized crime, it's best not to have cash. It's best to transfer objects so that you don't have cash movements that can be tracked. So we think they manufactured this demand for rhino horn in Vietnam with the cancer myth and with it being sold and distributed in clubs as a hangover cure. And so they resurrected this demand. So it wasn't a cultural old-fashioned demand. It was a new demand that was being generated.
So new demand gets generated in other ways, Jonathan. Obviously, I always think of economic development as a plus, if it can be made sustainable. Part of getting at the poaching is to provide other livelihoods. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, in that sense, it is a positive thing. But do you see the problem just move? In other words, as a middle class grows, the consumption of all kinds of things, including unsustainable consumption, happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big worries, of course, is that, and you boil down these things too, it's like the number of people and what we do, right, is sort of our collective impact. But we have to recognize that a very small number of us have a massively disproportionate impact, and depending what it is. We in North America have a massively disproportionate impact on climate change because we're gluttons in energy use. Maybe less so with rhino horn, that Vietnam is kind of disproportionately large. So we have to kind of look at that. But one of the things that's really critical, as I mentioned before, is, again, energy use, but also our diets. If, you know, as we have about 2 billion people now joining a global middle class. We never had a global middle class before. We had a small number of very, very rich white people and a whole lot of very, very poor everybody else. And that was human history for far too long. But now we have a middle, which is, you know, probably be like $8,000 a year, kind of would be the global middle class, maybe 10, something like that. But as is China, as the BRIC countries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, a lot of Southeast Asia, a lot of countries you work in. And they're getting a global middle class. And so the diets they choose will steer the future of this planet. It'll determine whether there'll be rainforest on Earth or not. That's huge. What will happen to Indonesia and Malaysia's rainforest is basically about oil palm and timber. So where's that going? Mm-hmm. In Brazil, it's about soybeans and beef, things like this. So the diets of Chinese middle-class people, for example, right, was driving a huge increase in meat consumption in China, fed by soybeans being grown in the United States and increasingly Brazil and Bolivia, grown in the Amazon. So increasing wealth in China was driving deforestation in the Amazon. Who knew? Welcome to globalization. Mm-hmm. So these things have, it's not just a wildlife trade, it's a trade in major commodities. This is going to be a trade in water, virtual water, the water we use to grow our food or make our goods, and also energy goods. So this is going to be a massive issue. And this is why, at the same point, it's really about changing culture. It's if we just follow, you know, the, well, this is the consumption mythos of the society we live in. This is what the markets are telling us, whether it's organized crime or TV, whatever. We don't have to live that way. We can, cultures can change. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're going to have to do is, and I'm a scientist, and I finally realized after a while the shortest distance to the world I want isn't because of we're limited by the science we have or the technology or the markets or the government instruments. It's really culture. It's just we haven't chosen to go to that world. So go, let's do it. And you can do it. And you've shown this, and others have too.
And that's why I think, you know, we've quite said for quite a long time, we think China can actually be a leader in this. Because when you, I've been going backwards and forwards to China multiple years, multiple times a year, and the pace of change is just amazing. I mean, when the government decided to stop smoking in public places, boom, you went from every single taxi you got in reeking of smoke and every hotel reeking of smoke, it cleaned out completely. And there is a much more sense of collectiveness. And on the food issue, we were asked by the Chinese government, they like what we're doing on wildlife, which is largely public awareness campaigns to help with climate change. And one of the issues we've looked at is meat consumption. Yeah. And but they were coming from it in actual fact from the health point of view, because with the increase in meat consumption and they're projected to sort of, you know, rival us by 2020, if they do what the government's asking them to do, which is cut current consumption by 50%, that'll be responsible for 1% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. But they were having health problems because suddenly diabetes, obesity, heart attacks, all these things, and they have an aging population. Mm-hmm. These were going to be massive problems for them. So there are many other reasons to look at it, but it is going to take a cultural change. And basically what's happened is the rest of the world has adopted the Western model of consumption and consumerism, and the planet's not capable of sustaining that with a Indian middle class, a Chinese middle class, and now it's going to be an African middle class as well, because Africa population is projected to go from 1.5 billion to 4 billion, and they are developing not in the old Western style model, which took decades, but the Chinese model, which took a decade. You know, and so it's great from the development point of view and pulling people out of poverty. That's the positive side of it. The negative side is it's already a depleted world that we have to get our resources from. And so we've got to work out a better model, a better way of developing. And the other issue, which I think isn't touched on, which has to be touched on, is inequality and income distribution, because you can't have that situation. You know, you've got to have people having different lifestyles and things like that. It can't be rich and poor so close together. So that's another issue that we've got to address. And they're all related to resource allocation and what we use. And aspirations, and we have to change our aspirations. It has to be less quality than just the quantity we've been going for.
Yeah. So one of the other modern realities is the mobility of people and the size of the diaspora. And as you were talking about, you were talking about how organized crime kind of has its tentacles everywhere, but there's also the fact that whole populations are going elsewhere and sending things home. I think of how many Chinese workers there are now in Africa and in Brazil and Latin America as a whole. Are they driving some of the consumption and sending things home?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's been massive construction in Africa funded by China, and some of it's really good. There's better roads than ever been before, but there's also individuals in some of those companies that are buying ivory, buying rhino horn. In some cases, I think they're just being approached because they're Chinese, and Chinese buy ivory, so let's go and sell to them. But that's definitely been a major problem. And in fact, when we took Yao Ming for the documentary, we had a school teacher at a school we visited next to a reserve, and the teacher said to Yao Ming, he said, please, Mr. Yao Ming, please tell China we're very grateful for the road that you're building, but why do Chinese people steal the ivory from us and kill our elephants? And, you know, Yao was really moved by that, but he said, you know, these people don't understand. And so that's definitely been part of it. It's also part of the rapid economic development. You've got things like the train going through Nairobi National Park, for example. But, you know, at the same time, Africa wants to develop. They want to get better livelihoods for people. You can't stop development, but you've got to try and find some kind of balance where I think if Asia could turn around and have it all happen again, they had very rapid economic development, which has been great in terms of incomes, but they destroyed a lot of the wildlife in the process, particularly in China. And the Chinese government now is setting up a lot of big reserves and trying to repopulate the wildlife. And I think if they had their time again, they'd say, we wish we'd kept these bits at the same time and set aside land for wildlife and kept that so we don't have to try and rebuild it. Mm-hmm. So there are lessons to be learned. And I think we can learn a lot of lessons from China, and I hope that China can become a leader, not just in the development side, but in also how we keep those other things going.
Mm-hmm. So as you think about sort of elephants coming from mostly at least the ones, the sources of the ivory coming from Africa, rhino horns coming from Africa, who's doing the killing and who's doing the selling? What's that supply chain look like?
Well, very often, I mean, it used to be that we used to think of poachers as very poor local people. It seems to be more now, they're more organized criminals. So in a lot of cases, it's not the people in the surrounding villages that are doing the poaching. And very often, they're your best allies in stopping poaching. It's people coming in, and it's organized crime. And the selling is then done usually by local middlemen. But increasingly, there's Chinese or Vietnamese in Africa acting as middlemen. And from there, it's shipped by all kinds of routes. I mean, one of the most popular mechanisms recently has been to get a huge log from a big hardwood tree and hollow it out and stick ivory inside the log and then seal the log back up. And there's been a bunch of seizures done like that. Sometimes it's being smuggled in tea and coffee consignments and all this. And the volume of trade is obviously massive with container loads going in. So the detection is very hard. And thankfully, people are shifting away from the sort of, you know, casual inspection to intelligence-based work, which is really the way to go in terms of enforcement, to sort of infiltrate these networks and work out who the people are. And there's been a lot more prosecutions recently. So last year was actually a record year for ivory seizures in places like Malaysia and Vietnam, but we think the trade was actually going down. It's just there's never been any seizures in Vietnam before.
So now, we have a law here when it comes to ivory. Yeah. Was that 2016? When was it an Obama?
Well, we've strengthened the laws. There's been laws for quite a long time, mm-hmm. but Obama, in partnership with President Xi, they both banned the ivory sales, yeah. and that was came in the beginning of this year and China last year.
Yeah. And you played a role in that on the Chinese side, did you not?
We did. We were largely working with Yao Ming. So Yao Ming is actually a member of the National People's Congress, which every year meets, and people are able to put forward resolutions. And Yao Ming put forward a resolution asking the Chinese government to ban the ivory trade. And the U.S. government under President Obama was very good because they didn't point the finger at China and say, you're the bad guys. They said, we have a problem too. Let's solve it together, which is always the approach the Chinese like. And the two countries put the ban in. And the good news is that even just the announcement of the ban, the price of ivory fell from about $2,100 a kilo to about $700 a kilo. Mm-hmm. So the price went down to a third. The seizures into China went down by 80%. And I was just in Kenya 10 days ago. And some of you might have been to Daphne Sheldrick's orphanage where she has the tiny baby elephants, the orphans there. And I went and I said, oh, your orphans are all looking a bit big. And they said, well, we haven't had an orphan come in for 3 years. So the poaching in Kenya went from 390 elephants 4 years ago down to 60 this year.
Yeah. And the ivory, the carving of ivory has gone down too. There's sort of
that
whole industry.
We had a meeting a few months ago in China. And it was quite interesting because they had ivory carvers there, and the ivory carvers, I mean, a lot of the stuff has just been cheap, tacky stuff, frankly, chopsticks or cheap commercial stuff. The real craftsmen of ivory are like, well, we're going to keep working in museums. We're going to keep working restoring stuff and things. So we're going to actually stay in business. And they weren't actually too upset, the real craftsmen. But the commercial element has gone down a bit. There's still stuff going on through the internet, but all the retail outlets have stopped. So it's much harder to find ivory now in China. Yeah.
Now, elephants are lovable. They're not only magnificent, but they're intelligent. What do we know about them? Their problem-solving skills, their capacity for empathy. What do we know about elephants?
Well, we know it's tough because when they raid crops, it's really hard to stop them raiding crops because they know all kinds of things. Like this electric fence, they'll drop a tree on top of it to get through. So they're very tough elephants. I think the thing that's sort of impressive about them, I think when you see them and you know, and thankfully there's still places where you can look a wild elephant in the eye and you can see the intelligence in there, but they are one of the few species that kind of mourns their dead, where they come and find bones from elephants, they'll play with them and sort of look at them. They have a sort of self-consciousness about it. So they're definitely very, very, very smart animals, very caring and in a social group. And we've seen with the elephant orphanage is that the keepers, when they have these elephants come in, the babies, they have to sleep with them at night because otherwise they're so scared and lonely. But just the company of their keeper is enough to keep them going. So and they are remarkable animals.
So it's easy for us to care about elephants.
Right.
Are you finding the same kind of empathy when it comes to manta rays or sharks or even rhinos? Is that a harder task for nonprofits to mobilize public support around?
I think it's probably harder to fundraise for, but I think in terms of the protection, again, it's come on leaps and bounds. So, you know, one of the animals we're working a lot on now is pangolins. And did everyone know what a pangolin is? Does anyone not know what a pangolin is?
Go and describe.
There we go. Not too bad. We've got four or five hands coming up here. But you know, 10 years ago, probably nobody would have known what a pangolin is. And so they're scaly anteaters, a bit like armadillos, but actually extremely cute little animals. But they're actually the most heavily trafficked mammal in the world in terms of numbers. And in Africa, you know, hardly anyone's seen them because they're nocturnal and they usually underground and come out at night. But, a few years ago, probably 15 years ago, it would have been very hard to get people behind pangolins. But now what we're finding is that people, once they've got the notion that it's wrong to consume these animals, it translates from one species to the other. So whether it's the sharks, which shark fin consumption, the imports have down 80% in China the last 3 years. Shark fin consumption, and you'd think sharks would be difficult to get people to empathize with. But I think they understand now. There's a more sophisticated public understanding these are part of an ecosystem, they're part of a functioning thing, and doesn't have to be cute to be important to save. So the last time some Chinese officials were caught eating a pangolin, there was 7 million responses on social media condemning these guys and saying they should be locked up and all that. So the world has somewhat moved on in its sophistication in terms of doesn't have to be Bambi to be lovable.
Yeah. We've been hearing from Jonathan Foley and Peter Knights about the illegal trade of wildlife and wildlife products. After the break, we'll discuss what each of us can do about it. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Jonathan Foley. He's senior scholar at the California Academy of Sciences, and Peter Knights. He's executive director at WildAid. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, one word. And now back to our program.
So, Jonathan, what you specialize in is the interconnection amongst issues. When you were an academic, you ran interdisciplinary programs. I want to know, in the world of sort of immobilizing, in the world of politics, are we able to walk and chew gum at the same time? I have to say, I'm influenced by somebody who just came up to me a couple of days ago and said, climate change is the single most important problem and nobody should be working on any other. And I kept thinking, well, we can do more than one at once. Yeah. Do you find that there are issues that tend to trump others?
That's a fascinating question. Well, first of all, I think civilizations that want to succeed have to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time, and maybe even juggling a few things while they're doing it. That's called running a civilization. We seem to be able to do all sorts of nonsensical things at the same time. Maybe we could do some good things at the same time. So I would like to believe we can make people's lives better and healthier and preserve the future of our biosphere at the same time. And there's nothing stopping us except us. So I actually am very optimistic that we could do that. One of the things that's fascinating, too, about how quickly cultures can change, to getting back to your point, you know, like I was talking to my daughter about this the other day, and I said, you know, when I was growing up, when I was your age, you know, so back in the Stone Ages or something, no, not that long ago, but long enough, everything I was taught as a kid that could never happen, not only did happen, it was inevitable. It's like the end of apartheid. That will never happen. Of course it did. The end of the Soviet Union. Of course it did. The gay marriage, an African-American president. These are all things I was taught were impossible when I was a child. So, you know, think about that for a minute. Mm. So I like to, you know, the human capacity for change is enormous. So, but we have to get better at focusing on some of the bigger issues. This is where I do believe, though, the environmental community, sometimes we need to step back and look for the big leverage points. And that's, I call them like planet levers. You know, there's this guy, Archimedes, an ancient Greek, he wrote once, if you want to move the place, he's a physicist. He wrote, you know, give me a lever and a place to stand and I can move the world. And that influenced me when I first read that. So, yeah, we need to find those kind of leverage kind of systems. And to me, they're, you know, for if you want to talk about climate change, habitat loss, preserving our lands and waters, and keeping the environment clean for the future, food waste is the first thing we should start with. Yeah. Then we got to think about like energy efficiencies. We got to think about water efficiency. You know, and these are easy. These are all. By the way, everything I mentioned is basically one simple rule. Stop being stupid. You know, we don't have to break the laws of physics. We just have to stop wasting 40% of the food we grow. Stop. The Israelis use 1/10 the amount of water we do in California to grow the same amount of food. We use 1/10 the same amount of water as they use in India to grow the same amount of food. So between India and Israel, there's a 100-fold difference in how much irrigation water it takes to grow 1 gram of rice. 100-fold. There are massive opportunities for us to be smarter, better, without compromising our future aspirations. Yeah. This is the thing. Sustainability doesn't have to be a downer. Oh, by the way, we got to change the word. Are there any marketing people here? Or I hope so. Okay, we need you. God, we need you in the environmental business, because when we think the best thing we can go for is sustainable. I'm like, if I went up to you and said, hey, how's your marriage? You said, oh, it's sustainable. I'd be like, oh, God, I'm so sorry. That sucks. You know, I mean, like, you know, that's terrible. But can we come up with something better, like thriving or great or awesome? Or, you know, I mean, can we please come up with a better word? Because we need to aspire to something better. And this is where I think the environmental community, we've done a somewhat poor job of this. I think we need to change cultures by going for the most noble version of ourselves. I've never met anybody, I don't care who they voted for, red state, blue state, small town, big city, I don't care. Everyone I've ever met, and probably you've ever met too, wants a better future for their children and for the people that come after us. I've never met anybody who says, ah, screw them. I never met them, have you? And if we just ask ourselves, what would it take to get to that better future? But it turns out it's kind of surprising. A lot of it's good for us. A lot of it is totally doable. A lot of it is doable right now. And we just have to kind of get up and do it. And a lot of the things we just heard about the wildlife trade, hey, the world didn't end because people realized that, you know, rhino horn doesn't cure cancer. It's a fingernail on some animal's head. You know, come on. Same thing, like wasting energy isn't good for the economy. Wasting water is not good for the economy. I mean, hello. So I think we need to shift to focusing on the big things, but put it in a more positive light and hit our aspirations rather than our fears. And I'm sorry to go on about this, but one of the things that we often do in the environmental community is we want to hit our base. We do scary things. We'll put up, like, there are two movies about climate change last year. Al Gore did one, Leonardo DiCaprio did the other. I've worked on this stuff for 30 years, and it scared the hell out of me because they were designed to. They were designed to scare the activists and the donors, which is about 12% of the American population might identify with those values. But it pissed off 12% of America who listens to Rush Limbaugh, and a less 76% of Americans hiding under their beds. That's not where we got to go. We got to find ways to be positive, talk about solutions, about hope, about possibility, and really about envisioning a future where we can thrive. And that's going to be a fantastic place, and we can get there.
And I think you avoid fear and shame, don't you, in your approach?
We throw in a bit of fear and shame occasionally, but usually we also use comedy, and we do. It's very aspirational. You know, one person, we did surveys on our stuff, and we make a lot of 30-second messages, and they very high production value, featuring stars and CGI stuff and all this stuff. And one person said to us, oh, this is no good. This is like a Nike ad. I'm like, Nike ads actually work very, very well for Nike. And so, you know, I keep saying to people is that, you know, we are trying to create a brand, and the brand is an aspirational brand, which is you're going to be on the right team, which is not buying a shark fin suit, because people like Yao Ming and Jackie Chan, they're all part of this brand, and you want to be part of that brand. And so what we're trying to do is reduce demand, but we're doing it not in the fear way. We're doing it in the aspirational way. So you want to be on the right team, the right guys, the cool people are doing this.
I love this, because on climate change, we're trying to do the same thing with Planet Vision. We're trying to like depoliticize this or departisanize this and say, wow, when you work on climate change, you're joining the same team as Elon Musk and Pope Francis and Michael Bloomberg and Arnold Schwarzenegger, by the way, most of whom are conservatives and Republicans I just mentioned. And like, don't you want to be on that team? I think any team that includes Elon Musk and Pope Francis probably is going to be pretty good. You know, I want to be on that team. And, you know, like, or Yao Ming, I want to be on that. And Jackie Chan,
And there's some very basic psychological things going on, which is that, you know, you can't always be negative because it turns people off. So we try and sugarcoat our message with special effects and funny things and the stars to be able to repeat it again and again, so people find it engaging rather than, oh, I want to turn this off because I'm depressed.
Yep.
And you're giving people the mechanism. What do you do? And, you know, we started off saying, don't buy it, but now we're saying, tell your friends and family not. So there's something else you can do. You can be active and you can be part of the solution. So I think it's hard because I think it's partly the way the media portrays these things. And, you know, the big thing I find very frustrating here is that it's always got to be a conflict and it's always got to be two people fighting and disagreeing. And usually, nobody is there. The journalists are not doing the role of saying, well, actually, this guy is completely wrong on their facts and this person is right. They just say, well, one person says this and one person says that. And so it's confusing, I think, for the public. And confusion works for the other side because it maintains the status quo. And a lot of it is just trying to get through that confusion.
Well, one other, sorry to add to this, but it's one of the things that's so important in this country right now, though I think it's a global issue too, but especially in the U.S. right now. Rates of anxiety in America today and fear are higher than they've ever been, and are that we've ever measured. We've been measuring this stuff for over a century, and also our, you know, the feeling of division in this country is higher than it's been since the Civil War. A really funny statistic, though, is that even though we feel more divided, we are unified in one thing. It turns out 80% of Americans agree. 80% of us, the vast majority of Americans, agree on one thing: we are more divided than ever. You know, that's bizarre, but it's true. So things that continue to polarize, you know, and drive wedges between people, this is exactly what the media and politicians want. But if you actually want to solve a problem and go beyond paralysis, that's exactly what you shouldn't do. And so finding bridges, finding ways for people to share and kind of rise above this artificial division, we're being manipulated, you know, by media and by politicians very deliberately, very consciously to incite paralysis. I mean, don't fall for it. We're not as divided as we think we are. Most of us actually share common beliefs, and we can get there.
Now, part of what is done in this field is to give folks the opportunity to do the right thing. You think about, in recent years, there's been a focus on how various companies can make social change, advancing the social good, kind of intrinsic to the value chain. Some of my reading and preparing for tonight, Peter, learned that Sotheby's stopped selling wildlife products before they were banned.
Right.
So it took a choice like that. Are you finding, as part of your work, are you looking at sort of airline carriers, the various intermediaries along the way that can actually get ahead of the law and do the right thing?
I was involved in getting the import of wild birds to this country for the pet trade reduced from about 1 million to about 20,000 a year. And a large part of that campaign was persuading 150 airlines not to carry these birds in so they couldn't ship it. And then we go to the politicians and say, look, the airlines aren't carrying it. How can you be allowing this to go on when the commercial interests are getting out? You're behind the curve. preserve. So I think, you know, legislation and private action sort of go hand in hand. And if the private sector is moving, the politicians will sometimes follow behind. And unfortunately, that's the way it's been going. It would be nice if it should be the other way around, because they're supposed to be looking after the long-term future. But unfortunately, it's so short-term now, the whole politics. And it's again where a country like China can maybe take a longer-term view than the 7 years elected. Mm-hmm. They can take a longer-term view and maybe make some more sensible long-term solutions.
And part of our role is to reward those companies that do choose to get ahead of the issue as well. As you were talking about sustainability, and Jonathan, I got question cards that asked about sustainability, but focused on sustainable fishing. And the question of, or should we be, one questioner even asked, is it moral to still be fishing? But talk a little bit about our oceans and the sustainability of our approach to them.
Yeah, well, so the oceans continue to provide an enormous share of the animal protein we eat on this planet, and will need to for a long time. There's not going to be a replacement of that. And the morality of that, I guess, is balanced. Humans do benefit from small amounts of animal protein. I think a lot of us in the world eat too much. Some people in the world maybe have too little. Plant protein can go a long way, though, and we should do as much as we can there. Aquaculture, though, is the fish farms, if you will, have actually been are now a bigger source of animal protein from the oceans than open fishing has become. So aquaculture, fish farms, are more than half of the fish eaten on the planet. At first, the idea was fish farms would be adding protein to the world's food supply because we're growing more fish. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's reducing the global supply of food because the fish we grow in these fish farms are usually carnivores that need to eat other fish. So we go out on the open ocean, harvest fish, grind them up so we can feed them to salmon. And or to what else would there be? Salmon, shrimp, things like that. These are very popular. Tilapia, on the other hand, you know, we shouldn't be eating carnivores, because that meant they got to eat a whole bunch of herbivores before we can eat them. So we got to eat lower on the food chain. If we're going to eat animals, eat ones that eat plants. Mm-hmm. Rule of thumb when it comes to food, the closer you get to the sun, the better off we're going to be. So eat your plants, or eat a little bit of animal protein if you still want to, and much less of the red stuff.
So, did you want to add something?
Yeah, there's another issue about sustainability of fishing. And a lot of the unsustainability of fishing is the mechanisms we use to fish.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
And here's, you know, you were talking earlier about a better solution. So, you know, no matter what people are telling us, the jobs that are being lost are not being lost to immigration. They're being lost to automation, largely. Mm-hmm. Yep. Automation is taking jobs away from people. Fishing industry is a classic one, where we have these massive automated trawlers and things like that going out. You know, if we were fishing by more traditional methods, rod and pole, and much more selective, which reduced the bycatch of turtles and all these things, higher quality of product and things like that, we could provide 100 times more jobs in the fishing industry, and we'd have more sustainable fisheries, and we'd have less bycatch and all this. So, you know, there's again something where we could have the same thing by changing the industry and making it less automated. We could have a much more sustainable fisheries.
To what degree does your organization, just WildAid, but do other organizations in your field work with local communities to gain a sense of what their values are? Mm-hmm. As you think through what your strategy might be and how they might play in that strategy?
We tend to be, from the nature of our work, we tend to be like a macro organization that's working on a country or overall, but we do, you know, we get to meet a lot of people in the field in the course of our work. So one of my great pleasures now is I've done a lot of work in the markets where I've looked at a lot of dead animals and parts of dead animals, which is pretty damn depressing if you love animals. But I'm getting to do a lot more work now in Africa and working with communities there and working with local people there. And one of the big things that hits you first of all is in Africa, many people from the middle class, there is quite a big middle class in Africa, have never been to their own national parks. So these places we pay thousands of dollars to travel around the world to go and see, people living like 20 miles away from them have not ever been to see. And one of my great pleasures is being able to take people now. We're taking religious leaders. We took a group of religious leaders in Tanzania, and many of them had never seen an elephant before. And we went out and we had this beautiful sunset in Tarangire. And I said, we had the Muslims and the evangelics and all these different groups there, the Catholic bishops and all this. I said, one of you's got a direct line in because this is an incredible view we're seeing here with these beautiful heavens all coming up in front of us. And they were, we then had an evening reception and they were sort of almost outbidding each other in condemning the poaching that was going on from a moral point of view. And so that was wonderful to see them get engaged in this issue from their different perspectives. And then, you know, spending time in some of the villages and talking to the people about what's going on from your point of view. And then you realize that, you know, for many of the tribes in Africa, they actually have a clan which is related to an animal totem. So there's the hyena clan and there's the elephant clan. And, you know, with Yao Ming, they actually made him an honorary warrior and named him after one of their historical figures that had come and saved their race to say, we need you to save the elephants for us because the elephants bring us income. They're paying for our schools. They're paying for our healthcare. Will you be our savior? And this honorary warrior. So that was wonderful too. So, you know, again, a lot of what we do is on the marketing and the higher end of things, but it's always wonderful to connect with people at the grassroots and really realize that, you know, nature is something which has an appeal and has a wonder to people every age and every culture around the world.
I know in Rwanda, where with those wonderful preservation of the gorillas, in the communities around the national park serve as guides. They note that the tourism industry is based entirely on these gorillas, and they are the greatest sort of bulwark against poaching.
Absolutely, but it's also lovely to take people and school children and things to actually go and see these animals that are literally there, but they've only ever seen them as potentially a nuisance or something to be scared of. And you actually go in the safari capacity in a vehicle and they come right up to you. And seeing people go through that transition is an amazing thing.
So talk about some good news. We've seen, not that you have already, but we've seen tigers come back in certain places in India. Talk about where you've seen a turnaround in what looked like a certain extinction.
Yeah, well, I mean, the elephants in 1989 were looking like they're going down the tubes, and now in many places they're coming back. And, you know, we're not that far away, I don't think, from now being able to translocate elephants back into areas they've been made extinct from. Once you make them safe, you can do that. There's quite a lot of that work going on now where entire parks in places like Mozambique, they're bringing back the wildlife and reconstituting it. The same with rhinos. The rhinos have come back in some cases. There were like 3,500, now 5,000 black rhino. The white rhino, the southern white rhino, was down to 50 individuals in the 1950s, and it's back up to 20,000 now. So if we can stop the poaching, the case of rhinos, habitat is less critical than many species. They can come back and do quite nicely, thank you. So, you know, it's possible to rebuild this, and it's possible to also see how so many of the African countries now are realizing the value and the tremendous income they can get, like Rwanda. Rwanda's been restocking its parks and building them up again because they're seeing these as investments. And so, you know, there is some hope out there. There's some good things happening. The overall way of the world is somewhat depressing and negative, but you see these beacons of hope and you see awareness going up. You see the valuation of these things happening, whether it's sustainable fisheries as well. You know, we work in the Galapagos Islands and some of that technology we've invested in, and there used to be 10,000 sharks, you know, poached a year, and now that it's stopped because the price has gone down, protection's got better. So you can see solutions to these things, as you've mentioned earlier. It's just about the will, the political will to get it done, and the public will to push the politicians to solve these things. So there is hope, and I think when you realize that this could be part of development as opposed to its versus development, then you can see the way forward.
We've been talking a lot about Asia as mostly as consumers and Africa as the source of the animals. What about Latin America? You think about, well, you talked about wild birds. Monkeys at some point were imported in large numbers. Cats, jaguars. What is, as you look at Latin America, what are the big trouble spots when it comes to wildlife preservation?
Well, it's the habitat again. It's a lot of it. And, you know, we talked about palm oil, and I've seen areas that, you know, somebody exactly what you said, they designated a national park, and someone in the audience said, well, that's now all a palm oil plantation. It took 5 years to designate it, and when you've done it, it's been converted to palm oil. So again, it's habitat destruction. There's problems with fisheries, again, being overfished. You know, again, you're seeing governments and people getting up behind this. We've had tremendous support in Ecuador. We've done a lot of work. We had the Ecuadorian soccer team some play fair with sharks. When they scored a goal, they do a little shark fin dance to tell people not to kill the sharks and things. You know, the challenge is largely habitat loss. But even jaguar now, we're seeing some trade in bones and skins as a replacement for tiger bones. So,
On the hopeful side, though, and like in Brazil, there was the Meia Road more recently. But in the mid-2000s, nobody thought deforestation rates in Brazil were going to go down. They dropped by over 70% in 5 years. And from a climate change point of view, that would be like taking every car in America and turning them off forever. That's not a bad thing. And that happened mainly because commodity supply chains around soybeans and beef started to get more scrutiny from environmental groups. And there are a lot of 80-20 rules like this. Half of the deforestation on the planet happens in two countries, Brazil and Indonesia, at least during the 2000s, and for four supply chains, soybeans and beef in Latin America mostly, palm oil and timber in Indonesia mostly. So you got four supply chains, two countries, and about a dozen companies responsible for 80% of that trade, including companies like Bunge, ADM, Cargill, and others. And those big Western public companies, some of them private, but mostly publicly traded, they would have, Greenpeace protesting their board meetings, and nobody likes that. I mean, people think profits are what drive companies. Like, no. Board members drive companies. If you want to piss off board members and make your point, that'll change a company. So they don't want to be protested. They don't want their lives turned into hell. So suddenly, these companies started cleaning up their act, not perfectly. And then groups like the Nature Conservancy would come in and try to help. Hey, let's design a way of growing soybeans that doesn't cause deforestation. Let's work on the land that's already there. Mm-hmm. There's been some problems in leakage where it's not happening perfectly, but that was a big win, huge win. And most Americans had no idea it even happened. And it was one of the most hopeful things from a biodiversity point of view, but also from a climate change point of view. Protecting rainforest is a double win from biodiversity and all the creatures that live in them, more than any other ecosystems except coral reefs. But also they lock up a lot of carbon out of the air and continue to do so if you leave them alone. Not to mention what they do for local watersheds and local communities if you preserve them. Very good things. So that's a really top priority.
Speaking of companies, I do want to take you, Peter, to one last point, and that is now we've got online sales of things.
Yeah.
To what extent are tech companies working with you to help with that problem?
They are, both in China and here, and they've been pretty responsive in wanting to do it. The trouble is that the traders shift. So, you put in a thing that says you can't put on ivory, and they start calling it white gold instead. So the big problem is the sort of anonymity of the thing that, they're now using WhatsApp in Vietnam, where they've changed the laws now and cracked down on it. Instead of having a shop where you go and it's there, they will actually WhatsApp you the picture of the rhino horn, and you don't know where it is, so it's harder to go and catch it and stuff like that. So the companies have been pretty responsive, but it definitely makes the game of law enforcement harder.
And then finally, Jonathan mentioned several environmental groups that are doing work. Are there organizations that partner with you in particular or going after the same goal?
We partner almost every one of our projects. We're partnered with people like World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy you've mentioned, WCN. There's a whole load of great organizations out there. And, I think everyone thinks we're all competing, but generally speaking, I think we know when they've got a common goal, we want to work on something, and it makes sense, we all work together in the right way.
Well, there's one. We could do more, though, because it turns out Americans spend about $80 billion a year funding environmental organizations. That's really good. If we can make them just 10% better, that'd be $8 billion worth of new activity. That's real money. And so I love to see the environmental groups collaborating more, but if we could kind of reduce some of the duplication of effort, finding streamlines, finding ways to leverage that activity, and also to share their stories better, I think we can get that 10% headroom out of great organizations that already exist. So it's great to see collaboration, but I think we had to push that a little bit more, because that's like a couple of Bill Gates right there. That's worth it.
And a lot of them, they'll bring their own comparative advantage. I mean,
exactly.
That's what's interesting. You've got your strategy, it it's focused on the demand side. Others are focused on the supply side.
A little bit of competition isn't a bad thing. It's what powers the capitalist economy. And so, you know, I think sometimes, as long as it's not duplicative, it doesn't make any sense. But if people, people said, there's another organization working in China. I'm like, it's 1.4 billion people. We need another 20 organizations working in China, please, you know.
Yeah. Well, Peter, Jonathan, thank you so much
for
sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jonathan Foley, senior scholar at the California Academy of Sciences, and Peter Knights, executive director at WildAid. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.